meditation is going really well and your mind becomes very quiet and you think, it feels like you have no more will. You're not actually doing anything. Nothing is happening inside of you. You're not thinking about anything. So you think, maybe this is it. Yeah, no planning anymore. Yay, the end of dependent origination. Unfortunately not. Why? Because of underlying tendencies. They were there before, now the underlying tendencies are gone.
Yeah, and to make sure it also works on YouTube.
Okay, on YouTube as well. Okay, yeah. So now the underlying tendencies are still gone. So we bring them back. Okay, underlying tendencies are back. Okay. So, unfortunately. But so what this means is that your mind still has an interest in the world. You haven't destroyed kind of the root defilements, yeah? And what you intend and what you plan is really the main thing here, but they have added this idea of underlying tendencies. It's a very important point in Buddhism because it shows that no matter how profound your meditation is, no matter how peaceful you are, no matter how happy you are, that thing has a limited life. Unless you have done something with the underlying problems, the underlying ignorance, underlying delusion, which is there. So what happens when you intend and plan in this way? Would you mind doing this one, Venerable? So what happens is that this becomes the basis for the stationing of consciousness. This is known as vijnana titti in Pali. And so when you intend, yeah, so the stationing of consciousness is then what the consciousness is interested in. So if you intend something, if you are planning something, that is where you have an interest. Yeah, that is what your consciousness is leaning towards, your interest in that area. Yeah, and so that becomes then the station, that is called a station for consciousness because that's where your consciousness is hanging out. Just using modern terminology here so everyone gets it. So the consciousness is hanging out at this particular state. That's what it's interested in. And you can know roughly what you are interested in by knowing your own mind. Yeah, if you know your own mind well, you will know what that station of your mind is. What happens when you are meditating? Where does your mind go? And this is kind of the critical way of knowing the station of consciousness. Is your mind hanging out? Does it like to think about the worldly things? Does it like to fantasize about, oh, what am I going to have, for lunch tomorrow? If you come here for the, sometimes there's a nice sutta about the people keeping the 8 precepts, which is wonderful, keeping the 8 precepts. You don't eat in the afternoon, there's no entertainment, and, this kind of things. But some people, when they keep the 8 precepts, they spend the time thinking about, oh, tomorrow I'm going to watch these videos, I'm going to kind of eat this kind of food, and they spend the whole afternoon like that. And the Buddha says, that's not the right way of keeping, I shouldn't say the wrong way, it's not the ideal way of keeping the 8 precepts, yeah? And what that means is that your consciousness is stationed in that sensual realm, because that is what you're attracted to. That is what interests you, that's where consciousness is leaning here. And you find this out especially when you go on a meditation retreat, yeah? When you allow the surface problems of the mind to calm down and disappear. And when the surface problems calm down, it's like your natural tendencies, your default reactions, they come to the surface. It can be hard to judge in daily life because we are so busy anyway, you don't really know. But when you go on a retreat and you calm down, you can tell more what your station of consciousness is. So where does your mind like to hang out? What does it like to do? Or is your mind always moving to peace when you meditate? Or is it sometimes moving to peace, sometimes to the objects of the world? That's probably for most people. They are sometimes going to peace, sometimes thinking about the world. Some people always thinking about the world. Some people always thinking about peace. Mind always leaping towards peace. And this is one of those fascinating things. I was wondering, I would kind of, the way Ajahn Brahm teaches meditation is very interesting because he says just relax and just allow everything to arise. So why does that work? Why is it possible? How does that work? For some people try that and nothing happens. You just think about dinner and all kind of things. But for Ajahn Brahm it works. And the reason why it works for someone like Ajahn Brahm is because the mind is already stationed in that place. He's already delighting in peace. He knows where to find true happiness. So his mind leaps towards that and it doesn't go towards these other things. So this is how you can see what is interesting to you, what you intend, what you plan, what your mind is moving towards. It is what decides the station of consciousness. So for example, if you sit down, you know, you wonder, am I going to get reborn in the Brahmaloka in my next life or not? The Brahmaloka is the very high realm, very high heavenly realm. We use the word heavenly, but you know, whatever, high realms. And these are equivalent to the deep samadhi attainments, yeah, in meditation practice. So are you going to get reborn in Brahmaloka or not? And the way to know is whether your mind heads towards those jhanas and bang, goes in there. If it does, then you're heading to the Brahmaloka. I'll look at this in more detail in a second. So this is what it means, the station of consciousness. It means where your mind inclines and where it finds delight and where it likes to hang out, basically. It does not mean where your mind is in ordinary life, because ordinary life can be very confusing here. So this is one part of it, and the other part which... actually, let's move on to the next slide. Yeah, so when there is a basis, consciousness is established. I don't think this is saying too much more. It's basically the same, similar thing from a slightly different angle, perhaps. And then the last one, when consciousness is established and grows, there is rebirth. Yeah, we're talking about rebirth, that consciousness really refers to rebirth here, into a new state of existence in the future. So once that consciousness is established in a certain way, pointing towards a certain future, pointing towards peace, pointing towards sensual pleasures, because that is where your mind likes to hang out, that is where it goes also in the future life. Yeah, this is the connection between consciousness in this life and then consciousness in the future life. So you can have some idea where you're going to get reborn by looking at your mind in meditation to see where it, like, what is the default state of your mind. That gives you also an idea of what the rebirth is going to be in the future. Yeah, so this is, you can see here the connection very, very clearly in this particular sutta. It also has the word grows here. Grows just means that it is always intending new things. Yeah, it is always kind of seeking out new things, so the consciousness is growing in that sense, in a sense that it's always kind of trying to, you know, intending new things and wanting new things and moving in a certain direction. It just basically means moving in a certain direction and that direction changing a little bit over time. And then there is a rebirth in accordance with that. Yeah? So your station of consciousness in this life, becomes the platform which then carries on into the future life. Yeah, there's a direct correlation there between those two things. So that is the idea of how then rebirth happens. Yeah. So you might ask, well, what happens if you are in the sensual realm, for example? Let's say that you think a lot about sensuality. The sensual realm is a very broad one. You have goes all the way from the very high heavenly realms all the way down to the really dark realms. Yeah, the animals and the ghosts. Yeah. So where are you going to get reborn if you're inclining towards sensual pleasures? And the place that is then decided by the karma you have made in this life. Yeah? But this is the other aspect of cetheti and pakkapeti, the planning and intending. Yeah? Your mind is directed towards sensual pleasures, but the karma that you have made will then decide whether it's kind of below or high sensual pleasure. Yeah? You can have some idea of that as well in your mind, seeing how bright your mind is, how dark it is, because your karma will be reflected in your mental state in general. Yeah? Okay, so let's carry on. Otherwise, we will be here for a long time. And so this is the opposite, yeah? If you don't intend or plan or have any underlying tendency, if all of these things are gone, what happens then? You have no... There's no basis for the stationing of consciousness. Yeah, consciousness, intention, intending, and all of these things means that you have an interest in something in the future. If you don't intend anything, it means that there's no interest. Your consciousness is not heading towards anything. It's not stationed anywhere. It doesn't take an interest in any of these planes. Yeah. So all of that interest is gone. And when all of that interest is gone, it means consciousness is not stationed anywhere in this world. It doesn't have any relationship to anything in this world. It's free from all of that. And also the underlying tendency is also gone. So even when you come out of a state of samadhi, again, it's a similar kind of thing. There's no residue left of that thing here. Because there is no basis, consciousness is not established. And consciousness is not established and doesn't grow, then there is no rebirth into a new existence in the future. When consciousness is not looking to existing in the future, it is not looking to find delight anywhere at all, then it is not stationed anywhere. That's what it means to be free. Yeah, this is liberation of consciousness in this way. And then nothing happens when you die. That's it. Everything comes to an end. Is that good or bad? Everything comes to an end. Is it good? Yeah, okay. Is that a theory or is it coming from the heart? Theory. It's true, right? I mean, one thing is to kind of be a Buddhist. You agree with the ideas, but is it really coming from the heart? It's kind of, you know, maybe we can discuss that sort of thing afterwards when we have the breakout session. Is ending, is that good or is it bad? Okay, we'll discuss that later on, because actually it's very interesting here. And get a bit more clarity maybe if we discuss it a bit. That is one way of looking. I'm quickly going to have another way of looking at this as well. So they see here the same idea again. Mendicants, what you intend or plan and what you have an underlying tendency for become a basis for the stationing of consciousness. Yeah, same thing as before. When there is a basis, consciousness is established. When consciousness is established and grows, there is an inclination. So I was kind of saying before, when consciousness is established, what that actually means is that it inclines towards something. Yeah? It is looking to something in the future and inclines towards a certain state in the future. Yeah? This is kind of the idea here of consciousness. And whenever there is that inclination, it's like consciousness wants to move onwards. It wants to go on. Yeah, it wants to go there. It wants to create this future. Yeah? That is the problem. Yeah? When there is an inclination, there is coming and going. Yeah? Agati, agati, gati, agati, gati. Gati is like destination in the future. Yeah, one of the things in Buddhism. So I think this may mean, I'm not sure exactly what it means, but I think what it may mean is that there is no destination anymore for you. Yeah, if there's no inclination of the mind, then the destinations disappear. And because the destinations disappear, there is no passing away and reappearing here. If there's no destination, nowhere to go, you cannot pass away. You can pass away, I suppose, but you certainly can't reappear. Yeah. This has this idea of inclination of the mind, inclination of the consciousness in this life. That is what then leads to that rebirth in the future, the station in the future. Yeah. But if you don't intend or plan, yeah, again, all of the stations of consciousness are abandoned, and when that is abandoned, consciousness is not established. When it's not established and come to grow, there is no inclination. You're not inclining towards anything. Your mind doesn't really have any interest in any state at all. It's kind of hard to fathom, but that's what the Buddha says, so I guess it's true. Either the Buddha was wrong or it's true. Yeah. So I tend to assume the Buddha is right, but that's kind of what it means to be a Buddhist, I think. Yeah. So and when there's no inclination, there's no coming and going, yeah, existences in the future, and when there's no coming and going, there's no passing away or reappearing here. So this is how the Buddha explains it in the suttas. I explained it at length last time. I was using my own examples, but I really like to come back to the suttas, come back to where the Buddha says this. We say that we should just teach from the EBTs, so we should just read out the suttas, but you have to give a little bit of commentary, otherwise people might as well stay home and read the suttas. So kind of goes together. So what does this mean in practice? I will give you a practical example. So a mendicant enters and remains in the first absorption, or the first jhana. Yeah, this is one of the first states of deep samadhi. Thank you. So the question here that this sutta deals with is, how is it that you get reborn in the Brahmakayika loka, or the Brahmakayika, what's it called? Brahmakayika loka? Anyway, it's in company with Brahma. Yeah? If you want to hang out with Brahma, how do you get to hang out with Brahma? Mahabrahma is this awesome being, yeah? Full of metta, loving kindness. It's kind of nice to hang out with, especially if Mahabrahma is a Buddhist. If not a Buddhist, then it's a bit more problematic. Yeah? But sometimes Brahma has to be converted. Once Brahma is converted, then Buddha did that, so the Buddha has already done the work, so now we can kind of go and hang out with the Brahmas. But how does that happen? How do you enter and remain in the first jhana state? How does practice in the jhanas lead to rebirth in this realm? And sometimes you will hear people say things like, if you attain a jhana state, then you will be reborn in the Brahma Loka. But it's not as simple as that. Yeah? And this sutta explains how it happens. So after you have entered and remained in the first jhana, you enjoy it, you like it, and you find it satisfying. Yeah. So and this is similar to the idea of the stations of consciousness. Your mind is inclining towards this. Yeah? We talked about inclining just before. It's inclining towards the jhana. If you enjoy something, your mind is inclining there. Yeah. If you enjoy certain food, your mind inclines towards that food. If you enjoy dependent origination, your mind inclines towards Dhammaloka Center on Saturdays. Yeah, and so you like it, you enjoy it, you find it satisfying, your mind is inclining in that direction, and that is your sankhara. So when you will something, you will in that direction. You do acts which allow you to go on retreat, which allow you to be peaceful, because you want to experience these states. Your mind is heading there. It does not mean that you are in jhana all the time. Yeah? Sometimes you hear about these kind of jhanas that people supposedly experience, where you are in jhana too easily, yeah. Anyway, that's for another time. I said to Lehar that maybe we can do a course on jhanas and nibbana in early Buddhism at some point. But that's we'll have to wait for that course. Talk about those things. So this is important. Yeah, your mind is leaning towards this. This is the sankhara part, and because your mind is leaning in that, you tend to abide in those jhana states. Yeah. You are committed to them because you find delight there. And you meditate often in these jhanas without losing them. Yeah. In other words, you access them whenever you want. You don't lose them. Yeah. So that inclination of the mind, the station of consciousness, remains. Yeah. And when that remains, then when you die, because the station of consciousness is there, then when you die, your mind will automatically go into the jhana state, and then you get reborn accordingly. This is how it works in practice. Yeah, so you have to get reborn in a jhana state is not. It takes a lot of commitment to the path. This is essentially how these things come about. Okay, so let's take a break there. I promised Venerable to be quick because, as always, we have a lot of things to cover. So let's take a short break.
Yes.
Yeah, and then we'll have some questions.
Or a long break.
Yeah. A long break, okay. Okay. Okay, so let us do some questions or comments. Does anyone have any questions they would like to ask or comments they want to make? Everyone? Yeah, please, sir.
Can I just clarify something that gets a bit confusing for
Absolutely.
Me?
Absolutely, yeah.
When you talk about reincarnation of the soul and that, obviously you mean the rebirth of the ego in this life, not a reincarnation of there is no self that can be reincarnated.
Yeah.
So you clearly don't mean that, right?
Maybe I do. Okay, so this is the thing. Yeah, this is the thing about dependent origination is that if you look at the links, yeah, it has the rebirth in there, and as we looked at before, you know, the way it defines rebirth, it defines it in terms of ordinary rebirth. What we mean when an animal gets reborn in the animal realm, a human in the human. It actually uses that kind of vocabulary here.
Sure, but that's a spiritual language. That's not a literal.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not meant to be taken literally, is it?
It is. There's no indication. It is not meant to be taken literally. Yeah. You know, everything in the... I mean, if you think it's a spiritual language, you would have to find some kind of clue that is what the Buddha actually means. He means it in a spiritual way. Yeah. But he doesn't. He means it in a... It's very obvious he means it in a literal way. Yeah. You know, the way that the whole of Dhamma is defined, it is defined. The problem is the idea of rebirth in Buddhism. So yeah, you know, I would. It's not wrong to think about the rebirth of the ego. In fact, I will look at the sutta later on that shows how this whole idea of ego and conceit and I am the view, how that is very much part of dependent origination as well. It is part of it. It's part of the mechanism that drives craving, that drives us towards the future. But it is not. That is not what was meant by the word rebirth. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've been studying the suttas for donkey's years, and I can't see that there's any doubt about it. To be honest with you, even remotely about this, I think
Just looking at it through the lens of anatta, I don't see how it could possibly be taken any other way.
It can, because this is kind of the whole point of dependent origination, is to show how rebirth happens without a self, how it happens based on cause and conditions rather than an essence inside. It's just like in this life. Yeah, I mean, if you look at yourself in this life, you think about yourself today compared to what you were 10, 20, 30 years ago, yeah? And you would look at that, and that happens without a self, yeah? We can see that,
yeah.
Psychologists would agree. Yeah? And the problem is that, somehow we think that part of the problem is the modern or modern scientific outlook that, the mind somehow sits in the physical body. But that's not really the Buddhist idea.
Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah. So from the Buddhist point of view, the body is more like an extension of the mind in a sense. Yeah, the world exists in this fathom-long body. So for that reason, if you go from one life to the next one, it's not that different from going on within the same life. So if you don't need a self within this life to continue, you also don't need a self to go from one life to the next one.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
But so there's no self that carries on?
Absolutely. There's no self that carries on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Thank you for the questions. It's nice to get some questions like that, because these are important things to clarify. So thank you for asking that. Anyone else? Yes, please, sir.
Yeah, just a question on Sankara.
Yeah.
So you have Sankara as a second link.
Yeah.
And I think there is Sankara in under Nama Rupa as well.
Yeah.
So Sankara in one link is really a problem. To have it in two links is a big trouble. How do we handle that sort of...
There's a lot of that independent origination. Yeah, you have Vedana is in the fourth factor. This is also in the... What is it, seventh factor? Fourth and seventh, something like that. Seventh factor, roughly. Seventh factor. And so there's a lot of overlap in these ways, yeah? And you have that throughout the whole idea of consciousness occurs in two places at least, yeah? So the idea of dependent origination is to focus not on, it's not like one aggregate happens in each place. It's more like how the aggregates evolve, how the five khandhas, yeah, these five aspects of personality, how they evolve over time. That is the purpose. And because it shows evolution, it shows these aggregates in different shapes, in different places. So first of all, it shows you sankhara as the as the power which drives rebirth. Yeah, that's the second factor. But then it also shows sankhara as a resultant, as an effect of rebirth. Yeah, so first of all, it is the force that gives rise to rebirth, but then it's also part of the thing which gets reborn, like a human being. Yeah, part of what gets reborn is sankhara, because that's why you have sankhara now. So sankhara created you in the past, and now you have that sankharas because of that creation in the past. So there's different aspects of sankhara, different ways of looking at it, because we're showing the process of the five aggregates, five khandhas, over time. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Think about it a little bit.
Thank you.
See what happens. Actually, it's an important question, because one of the questions that many people have asked is, what is the connection between dependent origination and the five personality factors, the five khandhas? And I'll probably come back to that a little bit later on. But essentially, you can say dependent origination shows a way that the five aggregates, the five, how they evolve over time and how they interact with each other to create rebirth over time. Yes, please.
Talking about existence, Ajahn Brahm uses an example of stream of consciousness. How that is related to dependent origination? How it is intertwined? I struggled with that.
Thanks, Ed. You can talk about that later.
I'll talk about that specific thing later on, actually. We say that all the time, but expected your questions, you know. Everybody has the same, we all think in the same way, and we have the same idea, so.
We're all the same, basically. It's kind of boring.
But we've had a lot of questions about dependent origination before being monks, so we know sort of what people are thinking about, so that's why we prepare certain things, so it'll come later.
Do you want to answer?
Me answer?
Okay. Okay, so a few questions from... Oh, sorry, I apologize. Yeah, no, please, yeah.
So is this working?
I think so, yeah. Is it working?
Hello?
Yeah.
So my question is about your explanation of consciousness.
Yeah.
So are you saying that we should cultivate our minds so that our natural tendency is not to go to the material things in this world, like what's for dinner, or what I have to do next, or what's pretty, or what's not? We have to train it so that our natural tendency goes to something bigger. But then what is the something bigger that it should go to? Because it has to go somewhere.
Does it? Are you sure?
I don't know.
The thing about the Buddhist path is that it's not like should, yeah? It is about what feels right for you. If I say should and then you do something that you don't believe in, it's crazy. You have to believe in it yourself. So it's not about should, it's more about, I'm presenting this, this is the word of the Buddha. Now you think about if it makes sense to you or not, yeah? And if it makes sense to you, you might just start doing it. If it doesn't make any sense to you, you go become a Christian or something else, yeah? This is how it works. So don't think in terms of should so much. Think, does this make sense? And once it starts to make sense, you start to act in accordance with these teachings. So the nice thing about this is that the path that leads to all of these, this is very high teachings. Yeah? What you're getting here is like the core of what Buddhism is about. It's like, you know, so if it doesn't make sense to some of you who are beginners, I feel a bit sorry for you. Yeah, you're getting this kind of teachings. I know some of you have coming here for the, you know, you haven't really got that much background. It's actually quite hard to grasp some of these concepts. But the point here is that the things that lead to a happy life here and now, the things that lead to a good rebirth, yeah, if you believe in rebirth, and the things that lead to nirvana are basically the same things. So you can't really go wrong, yeah? So what you do, you start to do those things that lead to all of those things. And how do you become happy here and now? Basically, you treat other people with kindness and care, and you are compassionate and all of these things, and then you feel good about yourself now, it leads to a good rebirth, and ultimately, it also, if you carry on and you really take the path all the way, it actually leads to enlightenment as well. So take these teachings more as, don't take them as a should, take them as something to reflect on. Okay. Yes, Venerable, yeah. Would you mind using, yeah, there's a microphone coming.
So, Ajahn, could you say that Sankara is seen as a seed that is carried on from life to life? So our life experience is transmitted, if I can use the word?
So you're the master of seeds.
Yeah. The Buddha used a simile for seeds, and again, we have also slides on that also later on. The Buddha uses the simile of seeds in different ways. And in one way he uses it is he sees consciousness as a seed for rebirth, and that's the thing I'll talk about later. But there's also some places where he compares the sankhara to a seed. Right? So you can, sankhara is like the potential, the seed has a potential to grow into something. So this is a simile that your intentions, what the acts that you do in this life have a potential result in the next life. So in that way you can compare that to a seed as well, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, please, you would like to ask? Yeah, fire away.
Yeah. Something just popped into mind. It just seems like a reward system, like always working towards something, doing something to try and get to like a heavenly realms or something. Well, as soon as a reward system's in place, it makes the compassion in the present moment like contaminated.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, if it is like, if you desire, you know, I want a big Mercedes, a big house in my next life, and that's why I'm going to be compassionate now. Yeah, then it does contaminate it. If you do it with a sense of greed, it does. You're right. It does contaminate it. Yeah.
And it just seems like even though these things aren't materialistic, we don't want the house, we want this, but we do want to attain these jhanas, want to attain these things. It seems like there's still a reward system, but it's just that it's shifted, but it's the same thing.
But the thing is, though, that you know, after a while, you just learn to be kind because you know kindness is right. Yeah.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It also feels good. Yeah.
And yes, it feels good. Yes.
And that should be
authentic.
Yeah, and that should be the basis on which you do it. Yeah?
Yes.
And so, if you do it on that basis, then you know at the back of your mind that it will lead to a maybe good future life.
Yes.
But you don't allow that to drive your process so much.
So if that's a natural process, it just happens anyway. How come do we go into Buddhism and then try and muscle our way through all this stuff and enjoy and miss our miss our life, basically trying to muscle some sort of reward system and then losing the genuine compassion towards others in the present moment?
Yeah, well, it's not so much about it's not so much that you should think about these things and make these things, you think about the future all the time and kind of sully the here and now and not be present. That's not really what it means. What it means is that this broad ideas are there somewhere at the back of your mind. You know the larger reality of things, yeah? And the reason why we teach these things is because when you understand reality in a larger context, it actually changes your attitude towards things.
Yes.
So let me give you an example. For example, if you think that this is the only life you have, there's nothing after this, yeah? Well, then actually it makes quite a lot of sense to make sure that, you know, you get a lot of, you build up as much kind of, you know, money or whatever in this life, yeah? Because at least that's kind of tangible, you know, straight away what it is about, and maybe cut a few corners because it doesn't matter so much. But if you understand that all the things that you build up in this life, you have to let go and you have to give up when you die.
I've just carry on.
Yeah?
I've just seen one thing. How you're saying about letting go and not being born again, but the letting, you're still clinging to the idea of the next life, which isn't letting go. If you know what
you have to have some ideas. You cannot live without ideas. The question is whether you have ideas that align with the reality or ideas that do not align with the reality. Yeah. Yeah? So people usually say either life ends at death or you carry on. And usually people have have views that they hold on to, and some views are more conducive to practicing the path than others.
It just seems like you're driving with a car. Like if you're looking too far forward, yeah. you're going to miss what's in front of you. Yeah. If you're looking too close, you're going to miss what's there. It just seems out of whack a bit. Yeah.
Well, like so many things, there are right ways and wrong ways of using it. But if you use it like a reward system, you look into the future, yeah, and you're really greedy about it, it's not going to work. But if you use it more like an understanding of reality, that is at the back of your mind, not something you think about very much, but it's there at the back of your mind as a part of your outlook on the world that just makes you live well, yeah? Then it is a positive thing.
Yeah. Yes, all right. Thank you. I just thought I'd let everybody sort of know to try and be mindful to maybe get rid of the reward system and be genuinely caring because we've experienced these things and understand ourselves, not because of what somebody's
sure. That's the main thing, and I agree with you. But that is also a reward system. Yeah, you do it. You care and you're kind because you know it feels happy. So it's a pure reward system. It's something positive.
Yes, yeah? That's, oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, let's stop the discussion there. Bring it up later on again. Yeah. Okay. Ooh. Okay. Let's take a few questions from outside. First, from Gabriel, is it correct to understand that all this intending, planning, and underlying tendencies depend on avidya delusion, to arise? That's exactly right. Yeah. So that avidya, that planning stops once you have no delusion or ignorance. You don't plan anymore because you know that happiness does not lie in the future. There's nowhere to go. Happiness lies in the present, straight away, right here and now. As it relates to your question just now. Yeah. And there's a question from Lung Rui Fang. Probably pronounced wrongly, but I apologize for that. But in real life, we plan our daily work and life. Is it wrong then to do that? No, it is not wrong. In fact, you should do so. And if you don't do so, it becomes a bit wrong. You have to plan things in daily life. Yeah? Otherwise, it becomes silly. So remember that this dependent origination is not a prescription on what to do straight away. Just because it says here that willed activities leads to rebirth, it does. You cannot just stop rebirth by stopping planning in your ordinary life. What you have to do is you have to do things very gradually, and you have to know what to do at the right time. So initially, it is about planning in the right way, planning with kindness, planning with compassion, intending good intentions, yeah, intentions of goodwill towards other people, avoiding the anger and ill will, excessive greed, and all of that. So you start with those things, and then gradually you move on, and you purify yourself gradually. And then one day, maybe you decide to become a monk or a nun. I don't know what gender you are, but whatever it is, yeah, become a monastic. And then you carry on. So you do things slowly. You have to know how to do things in the right way. It doesn't mean that you can just stop planning or willing in your ordinary life. From Cortez, I thought Buddha didn't believe in the Atman. That's exactly right. The Buddha does not believe. I wouldn't say he doesn't believe. I would say the Buddha realized that there is no Atman. Yeah, and from his point of view, he knew that. And that is why the whole point of dependent origination, very important point of it, is to show how rebirth can happen without a self. And one of the fundamental aspects of dependent origination. Okay. From Michael Lightfoot, Ajahn, Nirvana just sounds like dying and staying dead, not coming back, which is what probably most people assume death means. Whilst the path to this sounds pretty dreary. Whoa, you don't understand the path. Yeah? Okay, where is the motivation? The motivation is happiness. Yeah. So the path, if you practice the path well, it's not dreary. Just like we were saying before, if you live with kindness and compassion, you tend to feel good about yourself. You feel much more happy. If you are a nasty character, you're not going to have a very good life at all. Good people are the ones that prosper and thrive in this world, not the bad ones. And the path of Buddhism is the path of kindness. This is one of the fundamental aspects, mentally as well as physically and verbally. And the highest happiness you can find in the world, according to the Buddha, are the happiness of meditation. Yeah, deep meditation practice. The highest happiness, the Buddha says, is found in the third jhana state. cannot have any happiness in samsara beyond the third jhana. Actually, you can have, but it's a different kind of happiness. So you go to the fourth jhana, there's no happiness there, and that happiness of no happiness is more happy than the happiness of happiness in the third jhana. Something like that, yeah? This is one of those kind of weird things on the Buddhist path. So it's, you know, this is the happiness in Buddhism. If you want to practice this path, you cannot go wrong in terms of happiness. And why do you want to kind of attain Nibbana when everything just disappears? The reason is because that is an even higher happiness. And this is what is so hard to get your head around. Yeah, this is why this is kind of mysterious. And the reason why it is so hard to get your head around is because the sense of self gets in the way. Get the sense of self out of the way, and suddenly this makes sublime and perfect sense to you. That is the hard part. Okay, last question. Richard Vaisagav. Question is the stupid question of Vatsa, when he asks where the fire has gone, could be possibly that the fire was transformed in other things, and it is not possible because it hasn't, or is it not possible because it hasn't got any real existence? There is no indication in the suttas that the fire is transformed. I know that there are some people who say that the fire goes into a latent state or something like that, as if there is something still there, yeah, carrying on. But actually, there's nothing really in the suttas to suggest that. And when the Buddha says the fire goes out and it does not go to the north, the west, the south, or the east, that's what it means. It means it goes out, doesn't go anywhere when the fire goes out. Yeah, it doesn't have any real existence, as you say. There's nothing inherent to the fire. It doesn't have to stay on afterwards. That is the obvious meaning of that sutta, and that's how, certainly how I understand it. Okay, we better carry on, I think.
Yeah. So with Ajahn Brahmali and me also last week, we talked a lot about consciousness, how that is conditioned by what we have translated as willed acts. The Pali word is sankhara, and it's a bit difficult to translate that, but we translate willed acts, but it means something like your karmic intentions. That is also a translation used sometimes. Some people had some difficulty understanding willed acts, so just know that it's just one possible translation for that. And Ajahn Brahmali talked about that this morning and last week, but I wanted to talk about consciousness and willed acts a little bit more. And specifically, I want to address 3 points. Namely, I want to give some similes that the Buddha gave for consciousness. For example, the one with the seed, venerable, the seed. That's because I really like similes. They visualize things and they work on a different level for me. You can look at things from a level intellectual, meditation level, but also the simile is also a level that it sort of sometimes brings up emotions that just mere words don't for me. So that's why I like to bring up similes a lot, and the Buddha did as well. So that's point one. I want to bring some similes of how consciousness works in dependent origination. And the second thing I would like to address, what is consciousness, right? And then I'll bring up the stream of consciousness, because the point is consciousness is not one solid entity, not one solid thing. It sounds like that if you speak about the consciousness gets reborn or whatever, and it sounds like a thing. But to the Buddha, it's not a thing. It's like a process. And that, I'll address that as the second thing. And the third point I would like to address is, why did the Buddha use the word consciousness here in dependent origination as the third factor? And why does he have its stand by itself like that, right? Consciousness, it almost, in some suttas, it sounds almost like the entity. Well, it's not an entity, it's a process, but it sounds like the thing that gets reborn. Yeah. So in certain suttas, it sounds like that, and I'll bring up some of those suttas later. And why did the Buddha use this specific term? Well, consciousness, the Pali is vijnana. And the reason, I think, is it's influenced by how the people used the word vijnana back in the days before the Buddha. The way we use consciousness is not not exactly the same as they would have used the word vijnana back in the days. Vijnana had a wider meaning and sometimes almost meant like, yeah, like in the Brahmins used it to refer to this atta that we talked about before, and that's the Buddha specifically denying that by putting consciousness as something that ceases. So those are the three points, the similes. What does the Buddha mean by consciousness, and why does he use that consciousness? First, before I do that, I would like to point out then, if we look at dependent origination and we see consciousness as the third factor being conditioned by these willed acts, these sankhara, then we're talking about consciousness in like a general sense. It means, for example, the actions you did in this life, they influence what you experience in the next life. So your consciousness in the next life in general is influenced by these willed acts. Because there is also a thing, independent origination, that talks about specific instances of consciousness. Like people may be familiar with the six senses, then you have sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, etc. And those are more like, it's also sometimes called momentary moments of consciousness. And I want to point out that that does not really come under this link from willed acts to consciousness, because that is more that falls under the links that are further down, which we'll discuss later today, is where specific instances of consciousness, they arise from sense impressions and sensations. So the link between willed act and consciousness talks about consciousness in a more general sense. The link from sense impressions and sensations also implies consciousness, but more in a momentary sense. I just wanted to make that difference clear. Is that clear to you also, that difference? Yeah? If not, we'll address it in more detail. So that first link from willed acts to consciousness, we've seen some suttas that address this with a lot of steps in between. Well, consciousness is established in a certain way, is inclined in a certain way, and then it gets reborn. And in some suttas, this link is much more direct, and I like this one. If a foolish person does good-willed acts, consciousness travels onto a good place. If he does bad-willed acts, consciousness travels to a bad place. So the foolish person, well, it means everybody who is not an arahant, really. So many of us here will probably be foolish persons, but foolish sounds a bit negative. The Buddha didn't have any negative connotations when he used the word, which is bala. It's sometimes, maybe you can think of it of unwise persons, right? So when you read in the suttas, the fool, and it doesn't mean like some kind of idiot or something, it just means anybody who is not an arahant. So here it talks about doing good acts, having good karmic intentions, then your consciousness travels on to a good place. And in bad acts, consciousness travels on to like a bad place. You see here the direct link between these willed acts and consciousness in the same sentence. It's actually relatively rare that you find it in one sentence. Usually there's these steps between that Ajahn and Brahmali pointed out before. And this sounds like consciousness travels on. It's a bit vague. What do we mean by travel on? Or what does the Buddha mean by travel on? Now you have to compare it to some other suttas. Here, this travels on. What does that mean? You compare it to some other suttas, and it's clear that by this he means that consciousness gets reborn in a next life, and not just in this life. For example, if you take this sutta, after his or her body breaks down, the foolish person travels on to another body. There's no mistaking that this is about rebirth, right? You have the same body in one life, really. So if you travel on to another body, that means rebirth. So just pointing that out here, that when we talk about will, action, consciousness, it implies rebirth. So, looking at this rebirth in more detail, and specifically this similes that I talked about before. Once Venerable Ananda asked the Buddha, "Venerable, you mentioned life, the bhava, which is another factor of dependent origination. But how does a life come about?" Now that Ananda is asking what is quite a deep question. How does a life happen, right? Sort of basically asking how do you get reborn? And now you could expect the Buddha to give a real in-depth explanation of every moment, what happens when you die and then what happens then. But instead, he gives this very simple, but I think very beautiful simile, where he compares things to sowing seeds. So the Buddha looked around him and he looked around in India. What did you see in those days? Oh, you saw a lot of people being farmers. Much more people back then were farmers compared to now, of course, because we have the Industrial Revolution, and especially in countries like Australia, we need mainly one, for example, just one farmer per 100 people. But in India, in those days, maybe 90% of the people were farmers. So these kind of similes that have to do with agriculture, you find them quite a bit in the suttas, actually. And there are similes about oxes plowing, about rain, watering crops. And here you see this man is sowing seeds. And of course, if you sow seeds, what do you do? You're sort of creating the possibility for a new life, right? In the form of a plant, of course. You don't sow a seed for a human being, right? Imagine that, sowing seeds and all the babies pop out of the ground. That would be something new. It would look funny. But the Buddha used this as a simile because he answers Ananda in the following way. Ananda, would life in the sensual world, that is the kama, bhava, appear if there were no deeds that ripen in the sensual realm? So the sensual realm, Jambamali said before, includes the human realm and also the animal realm and some other realms. And if there were no deeds that ripen in the sensual realm, deeds is here kama, and this kama is a
Synonym,
right, synonym. Synonym for sankhara. And so if we would do no things, that would result in us being reborn in the sensual realm. The Buddha's already hinting at a simile of seeds, because it's talking about ripening, and this includes like ripening of fruits. No, Venerable Ananda asks. And then the real simile comes. So with deeds as a field, consciousness as the seed, and craving as the moisture, the consciousness of beings who are obstructed by ignorance, that is the first factor of dependent origination, and tied to samsara by craving, it gets planted in the lower realm. The consciousness gets planted in the lower realm. That is how our next life is created. I find this quite nice because it's not really an explanation in depth, right, about how our next life gets created. It doesn't really explain how things happen sequentially or what you will experience when you get reborn. But it's really bringing us back to these things like the deeds, like the kama, as being like the problem, and craving. Craving is the moisture. And I'll explain in a bit more detail later.
I think this also, answers your question a little bit, Venerable Tenti, that sankhara is more like the moisture. Yeah, sankhara is very closely related to craving. Yeah.
So yeah, the field really is here as the field. Deeds.
Kama, okay. Yeah. Okay, okay. And it's a bit of both, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Okay, moisture and field, perhaps. Mm. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
And I'll explain it in a bit more detail later. Mm. Just finish this sutta first, because the Buddha brings up the same simile for the other realms, for the higher realms. Just go to that quickly as well. Ananda, would life with form, like rupa bhava, appear if there were no deeds that ripen in the realm with forms? No, venerable. So with deeds as the field, consciousness as the seed, craving as the moisture, consciousness gets planted in the middle realm. That is how a next life is created. Would life without form appear if there were no deeds that ripen in the realm without forms? This is like the one of the... This is the highest realm to where it's mind only. And because it's mind only, there is no form, right? No external shape. No venerable. So we did just the field, consciousness as the seed and craving as the moisture. Consciousness gets planted in the higher realm. That is how our next life is created. That is how life comes about, Ananda. So to sum this up, the Buddha says, with deeds, that is the karma, as the field, and consciousness as the seed, and craving as the moisture. And I thought I'd apply my drawing skills to this, and I came up with this. You see, it visualizes it a bit. So craving is what gives the moisture. Karma is like the field, and consciousness is like the seed that is we plant in that field. And of course, you can already visualize here, if you would have no craving, there would be no moisture, and the seed wouldn't grow, and then it would die, the seed, right? So your consciousness would not, it would cease, basically, it would end. And also, if you would not make any karma, then there would be no field, basically, for the consciousness to be planted in. And so then it also can't grow.
Your consciousness looks a bit like a potato.
Is that
intentional? Or?
I like potatoes.
You like potatoes, okay.
Maybe that's why. Yeah. It's supposed to be a seed, but it's a really big seed.
It's a big seed.
Wow, that's a seed.
That's potato.
Yeah. So with deeds as the field, consciousness as the seed, and craving as the moisture, consciousness gets planted in the lower, middle, or higher realm. That is how our next life is created. Yeah. You see here, consciousness gets planted in the lower, middle, or higher realm. So depending on the field, depending on the karma, your consciousness gets planted in different places. I've explained before how a simile that I made up, which the Buddha didn't have, but because it was a simile of driving a car, right? The Buddha they didn't have cars then, so he couldn't have that simile, of course. But I compared craving to the throttle of the car. You crave. It's like pressing down the throttle of a car and you move forward. And karma, I compare to the steering wheel. So karma is more like decides the direction in which you go, and craving provides the force of you moving forward in this car simile. It's the same with rebirth. The acts that you do, both by body and speech and mind, they influence the direction of your rebirth, and the craving can also have a certain direction in a sense, but this is more like what pushes you forward.
Maybe it's more like a really big supertanker or something, which has a lot of momentum. So even when you steer, it takes a long time before this movement around happens. Maybe.
Apparently, they have to like steer 20 kilometers before.
Exactly. It's because all the karma takes a long time to turn around. You do one good act, and you have to do many, many for things to turn, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. But I think sometimes we just think of in terms of this life and the next life, but there were also all these lives we had before, and the karma of all those lives before is also still might influence what's going to happen in next life as well. So my drawing skills again. So if you have a bad field, yeah, you have a bad karma, and then you plant a seed in a bad field, you do bad things, then you can expect next life is probably a bad life. Yeah, you get a really very small, little, weeny tiny plant.
So those rocks, they're the bad
yeah,
karma.
There's even rocks in the soil here. Yeah. So yeah. That's a bad field, karma. This, right? Bad, bad karma is a bad field.
Yeah.
But you can have a medium karma, a little bit better field, and then you get a bit better life as well. Or you can have real good field, like really moisture and really nice. The best field that you can find, and then you get a good life. Yeah. You can imagine like these farmers in the Buddha's time, like fighting to get the best field, you know. They would know just by looking at it, that's a good field, that's a bad field. This is going to create good crops, and this is a lot of bad crops. So, sort of, these kind of similes sort of makes it more alive in a sense, but also sort of brings you back to the time of the Buddha, I feel. Yeah. When you see, sometimes dependent origination get really technical, and there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes the Buddha explained it in very non-technical ways, really. But it hits another chord for me, and I really like these kind of similes. But the simile doesn't finish there, because the point of dependent origination is not to do good things so we can get a good rebirth. The point of those teachings are really to see that there can be good rebirths, there can be bad rebirths, but sometimes you get reborn in a good place, sometimes in a bad place, but in the end we want to get out of this rebirth altogether. Not just have good or bad, get out of altogether. Sort of this this question about that was brought up about the reward system. I think you can look at it like if you do good things, you get good rewards, but dependent origination also includes if you do bad things, people get bad rewards. So in a sense that does, if you look at it that way, that does create a lot of compassion, because you know, nobody is perfect, well, unless you're an arahant, so they will always do some bad things and have bad results from that. But the point is to have no craving and consciousness not get planted. I don't know why it shows already half of the sutta down here. This laptop has a mind of its own, I think. So the point is if you don't have craving, you don't give moisture to the seed, yeah, and you don't plant consciousness, then there will be no next life. If you don't pour water on the seed, then it can't grow. And there is this nice sutta on the Bhikkhuni Sela, and it refers to this simile as well. And it's quite a famous one, I think, this sutta. Just as a seed sprouts when sown in a field, based on two things, nutriments in the soil, so that's like the karma, right? The field, and moisture, the craving. So the aspects of existence, the khandhas, the elements and the six senses, which are sort of implied by the khandhas, have come into being dependent on conditions and cease when those conditions end. And the main point of this sutta is really to refer to because things, these khandhas, depend on conditions of craving and karma, if those conditions end, then those khandhas have also to end. it's often when you live life, it feels like consciousness is sort of the underlying thing beneath everything, right? And out of consciousness arise your actions. The Buddha's saying it's really the other way around. From actions, you get the consciousness.
Do you want to have a short break?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. Good place. Are there any questions? No questions? It can always mean either something good that everybody understood or something very bad that nobody understood, and they understood it so badly that they can't even come up with questions.
Just wanted to check, like here you were explaining the process in the bhava.
Sorry?
The link at the bhava. You were just explaining, yeah, which is at the down the line in the dependent origination 12 links. But up at the front also there is from sankhara to vijnana to nama rupa.
Yeah.
So in there, the sankhara, would that include both karma as well as craving? Because craving isn't up there, but it's got to be there at that side as well for the rebirth to happen.
Yeah. Yes, you have to have both the karma and the craving. They sort of imply one another. If you have one, then you have the other. And these sequences in dependent origination from the sankhara to vijnana and from craving, upadana and then bhava, those two sequences are really parallel sequences. They explain the same principle from different viewpoints, if you were, they're just using different words. And that's why in some suttas you'll find both of the factors like consciousness and bhava, you'll find them together. Almost as synonyms, almost. So that's implied in.
So yeah. Sankhara there would also include both craving and karma.
Whether it technically includes it or not, I wouldn't say so. But it implies it. You know, if you have sankhara, then you also have craving, and how we define things, well, it's just a matter of. Do we put craving in the same box as sankhara or not? It's really just a matter of definition. But technically, I would say no, but that's just from a technical point of view. Ananda.
Thank you, Venerable. In your simile, Venerable, that you have the three things, the craving, the kamma, and the consciousness. Well, I'm mixing the languages. Would you say the Four Noble Truths, the second one, the Buddha gave as the primary factor, tanha, craving, that drives us from birth to birth? So would you say out of the three, I think comes to mind that in the Madhya Sutta, there is a word called Sibbati, Ajahn, I think.
Sukhati.
That simster, that it is the one which...
Sibbati.
Sibbati. Stitches us into this. So would you say out of these three things, the pivotal thing is the craving?
Again, they are sort of implied in one another. It's sort of the same answer that I gave Venerable before. I wouldn't say one is more like primary than the other. If any one of them would be, it would be like consciousness is like the primary thing, because without consciousness, without being alive, there cannot be any craving. And then there also cannot be any deeds, any karma, right? But it's not like craving takes precedence over karma. Right? If you are the kind of person that has craving, if you're not enlightened, then you're also the kind of person that does these willed acts that will lead to rebirth. Yeah. They're implied in one another, almost being sort of, well, not really synonyms, but like maybe metaphors or something. Yeah.
Thank you. On a different point, you mentioned that, Venerable, that only the arahants are the sapurisa, if you like. You use the word, not the fools or bala or...
Yeah, in different suttas, actually, it uses the word fools in different ways. Sometimes they have fools versus everybody who has seen the Dhamma, all the Aryas, like stream winners and beyond. And sometimes it has fools versus arahants. So depends on context.
Okay. That you answered that it's the, from, you used the word stream enterers, but would you include the people like Saddhanusaris, Dhamma followers, and the faith followers as Aryans, or are they still tottering in the at the bottom?
I don't know how it's technically defined in the suttas as Aryans or not, but they haven't seen fully the Dhamma yet, so you could call them still. You could put them under the fools, but then again, you could also put the stream winners under the fools as well, and the non-returners as well, if you have them versus the Arhats, right?
Yeah. But I think one of the things that these terms are used very flexibly in the suttas.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are certain suttas where the wise person is actually a putujana, ordinary person, not even an Arya, yeah? And then the fool is just the putujana who uses bada, who acts badly. So it's a very flexible terms, and you have to know the context to know exactly what they refer to. Huh?
Yes. But in the sutta I gave before, their fools refers to basically everyone who is not an Arahant. It's like, I could say the most widest definition, widest net.
Thank you. Sad.
Please.
I was just thinking, getting, how can I say, not being reborn is such a good thing. Well, I think we might, wouldn't, this world probably needs all the bodhisattvas they can get. So if it's somebody who is, say we've got a cold-hearted intellect or a good-hearted fool, somebody who's clinging on to helping others and being selfless, and they come back as bodhisattva, which is like helping people again, while not in this form. Just seems that letting go of everything will stop any bodhisattvas from coming back and not being reborn.
Well, I think it's also like the Buddha taught these things, right, about not being reborn and consciousness ceasing. And I think if you teach certain things, you also have to live up to the example, right? Yes. Practice as you preach.
Yes.
So the Buddha, he didn't come back. He's not here right now.
No.
He gave the example.
Yeah, so what would be better? It seems that the most important, the best thing in this world is a parent, parenting a child. There's a selfless love for a child. So wouldn't that be the most powerful thing?
Well, most powerful.
The highest thing would you know, the like Mahayana preaches great wheel of compassion. I mean, all this talk about compassion, and I don't see very much of it.
Yeah, well, compassion is very, very important as well. And
yes.
The compassion comes, the less sense of self you have, the more compassionate you will be. Because the less you think about yourself, the more you think about others.
The more importance we put on others, so therefore we're craving to do that, therefore we're going to be reborn a bodhisattva and come back. Therefore,
but also the less sense of self you have, the less craving you have to exist.
Less sense of self we have is less sense of self we have for others too, isn't it, caring?
No.
Not really?
Not really. A sense of self is almost the opposite. It's like being egotistical, yeah. So the sense of self means that you're looking after yourself. That's what it ultimately means. If you give up your sense of self, it means that you have the ability to care more.
But it's postponing caring for others, and it's just sometimes it's not always wise to postpone.
I'm not postponing at all. These things go together. First of all, to be able to reduce the sense of self, you have to have compassion. Because when you're not thinking about yourself, you are more compassionate.
Towards others. Yeah.
So the sense of self actually gets in the way of compassion.
Yes,
so so the less sense of self you have, the better it is in terms of compassion and helping others.
When we start digging, it starts getting, there's a lot that pops up, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
You probably won't get all your questions answered on this course.
I'll just give some food for thought for people.
That's the idea, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, all these teachings are related. Of course, compassion is very important in Buddhism, and we don't mention it here very often because it's only so much we can talk about.
Yes,
but thank you for the question.
Thank you.
All right.
You better carry on, I think.
Yeah, okay. Good. Yeah. Moving on. No, I don't have too much. I don't think I can do all that I promised to do, but we'll see. So this is a very standard line from the suttas. We talk a lot about dependent origination, but there is also dependent cessation. And this is a standard line that happens in almost every sutta on dependent cessation, when all these conditions end, if the willed act ceases, consciousness will cease. If the sankhara ceases, consciousness will cease. And for that, there is also a nice visual simile. When liberated by ending craving, ending the condition of craving, the mind's deliverance, the mind's liberation, when consciousness ceases, is like a flame going out. Somebody already addressed before this question from the internet about the fire going out. What is that? What is that like? Yeah. And you see here in the picture, and the left candle has a flame. The right candle, there's no flame. The flame has gone out. Yeah? And you see here, this is when consciousness ceases. That is like going out. So the nibbana is like a synonym for cessation. When we talk about dependent cessation, we could also say dependent nibbana, in a sense. Nibbana is like a visual simile of a flame going out, a visual simile for this cessation process, and it's used a lot in the suttas throughout. But here it's very directly only talking about consciousness ceasing. It's one of the most challenging aspects of Nibbana. Right? Craving ceasing, that sounds, yes, everybody wants craving ceasing, I suppose. Sounds like some liberation. Consciousness ceasing is also liberation. So mind is a deliverance. Harder to realize that that is so. So, talked a bit about those similes about seeds and plants. And I think we haven't really talked about what is meant by consciousness in dependent origination. We've used the term, but we didn't really explain it, and that can lead to misunderstandings if we don't explain it in more detail. Like, here is somebody who had a misunderstanding. It was a monk named Sati, who was a fisherman's son. Had the following bad view. As I understand, the teaching taught by the Buddha is it is this same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, basically, that gets reborn, yeah. Not a changing one. The sutta goes through a lot of details how this monk Sati tells that to other bhikkhus, and those other bhikkhus say, no, I don't think the Buddha taught like that. Let's go to the Buddha, etc., etc. And then the Buddha asks him about it. And I skip all that. And then the Buddha comes to Sati and asks, what do you mean by consciousness? And Sati answers, Venerable Sir, what I mean is, it is that which thinks and feels, which in various places experiences the results of good and bad deeds. It's like Sati has an idea of consciousness being like some sort of entity inside, some sense of self, some me inside, like almost like this. It's a bit hard to see on the slide maybe, but like a controller inside himself, the one that thinks, the one that feels, the one that speaks and acts, like the doer and the experiencer of everything. But then the Buddha, confused man. Again, almost like foolish man. Right? I taught in many discourses that an instance of consciousness arises dependently, that a consciousness does not come into existence on its own. And here the Buddha is alluding to this momentary thing of consciousness. Again, when I first started talking, I pointed out this difference between consciousness in general and then consciousness, moment to moment. And here we come to that more.
How long is a moment of consciousness?
You're asking the difficult question. I can vary, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'll let it go.
A consciousness is named according to what it depends on. When a consciousness arises dependent on the sense of sight and sights, the eye and sights, sometimes translated like that, it is named sight consciousness. When on the sense of hearing and sound, hearing consciousness. When on the sense of smell and smell, smell consciousness. When on the sense of taste, sometimes translated like tongue and taste, is taste consciousness. When on the sense of touch and tangibles or touch consciousness, mind and mental phenomena, mental consciousness. And this really falls under the factor of dependent origination called passa, or contact, which we've translated sense impressions, and that we will explain later in more depth. But again, all these teachings are interrelated, so here the Buddha alludes to this teaching. So the point here being that there is no consciousness entity. Yeah? It's like this glass, you could say, is like an entity, it's a thing, right? Consciousness is not like that. Consciousness is not a thing. Consciousness is more like a process, and it's changing all the time. Sometimes it's sight, sometimes it's smell, sometimes it's taste, and those things are different, and they're not an essence. So when the Buddha talks about consciousness, he doesn't mean just one thing. As in the definition used in the suttas on dependent origination, when the Buddha defines every term of the 12 links, here is how he defines consciousness. What is consciousness? There are 6 types of consciousness: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mental consciousness, sometimes translated eye consciousness and ear consciousness. But I like to translate it with sight and hearing. Those together are what's called consciousness. So when the Buddha uses the word consciousness, independent origination, it is like just a label for various kind of experiences all put together in one. It's not a thing. Does that make some sense to people? Those who have been coming to Ajahn Brahm's classes will know that he translates consciousness in this context as consciousnesses, right, in the plural, not just a consciousness, but consciousnesses. And that's very good, actually. I like that a lot, because it avoids this confusion that the monk Sati had, that there is a one almost like soul-like consciousness. That's not what the Buddha meant when he used the word consciousness.
There's one other point here which is kind of interesting. I'm not going to go too much into it, but very often in later Buddhism, in the commentaries and things, they talk about the Patisandhi Vijnana, which is like the rebirth linking consciousness. And this is something you find in the Abhidhamma, for example. And that is the moment that consciousness arises in the next life. But if you look at the definition here, it includes all 6 kind of consciousnesses. Patisandhi Vijnana, because it's only one consciousness, the re-arising one, could only really be one moment of consciousness. And it would have to be usually mind consciousness, because the other senses don't exist yet. So this, I think, is a different way of looking at it from the what you find in the Abhidhamma. And the idea is here is the idea that the whole of the mind, with all the different consciousnesses, that is what gets established in at a new vijnana titti, a new station of consciousness. So for those of you who are kind of used to this kind of terminology, Patisandhi Vijnana, then you know, some of you won't, so don't worry about it, but just as a matter of, just a brief point.
Yeah. So there's another simile that is in the suttas. It compares consciousness to a stream. This was brought up before. And it doesn't occur very often, but this is a place where it does occur. Sariputta says, the Buddha knows a person's stream of consciousness if it is planted right back in this world when it's reborn in this world, and also if it's planted in another world when they get reborn somewhere else. The Buddha knows. He knows where people get reborn. But the point here is he calls it a stream of consciousness. And a stream, of course, is just, it's a name for, not for a thing, not for a solid thing, but for a more like abstract concept of flowing water, and the water in the stream is always different. It's not the same water. It's not the same water drop that stays in the same place. It's always constantly flowing and changing. The stream doesn't have by itself a core inside of it. Does that make sense also to you who asked a question before?
Ed?
He's shaking his head no. Yeah. So Well, maybe this is the confusion. Nowadays, we use stream of consciousness in psychology or in, I think, in making movies. You have the word stream of consciousness. And it means something totally different from how the Buddha uses it. When he uses, or Sariputta here uses it. They don't use it in this modern sense of psychology, how they use the word stream of consciousness. It really mean like a physical stream. Like comparing it to a physical stream, I would say.
Yeah. The way I usually think about the idea of stream of consciousness is like if you think about a river or a, you know, or a water flowing. Yeah. When you look at that river from moment to moment, the overall shape of the river is pretty much the same. Yeah. It takes a long time for the shape of the river to change. It changes when there's more rain or the seasons change or the snow is melting or whatever. But the general shape of the river, it tends to be the same and only gradually evolves over time. And that's like human life moving from one existence to another one. They're only gradually changing. Yeah. But if you look at the actual river, if you stand at one point and you look at it one moment to moment, it's a different molecule all the time. It's not the same molecule. Yeah, it's a different river at every point. Even though the shape of the river is the same, the actual molecule which passes in front of you is a different one. It's like a moment of consciousness, yeah, and the next one. And there is no connection between the two apart from causality. One moment is not the same as the next one. One molecule, not the same as the next one. Anyway, there you are. Yeah. That's my...
And that's how I look at it as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, by consciousness, the Buddha doesn't mean a thing, more a process. Life is a process. Life is not made of a soul or something like that. And I think I'll stop there because it's time for lunch. I also wanted to talk about why the Buddha uses the word consciousness. I'll do it really, really, really quickly. So there's these sentences like consciousness that roams and transmigrates, the stream of consciousness traveling on, we've seen before. There's also in other suttas these onflowing consciousness, which also refers to rebirth, or the planes of consciousness. Why does the Buddha use the word consciousness? And consciousness is really used more widely in the Buddha's time. Here we have consciousness vijnana is a synonym for the words mano and citta. Where's my mouse going? Yeah, mano, citta. They're synonyms for vijnana. And this, by the way, is a wrong view. That which is called psyche or mind, the citta or mind, mano, or consciousness, vijnana, that self is permanent and eternal. This is a wrong view somebody had in the time of the Buddha, but you can see the kind of ideas they had about consciousness, yeah, about being this almost like a soul or a self. And the Buddha is refuting that by his definitions and by this conversation we've seen before with the monk Sati. And I won't read all this out, but this is from a Brahmin text and it talks about the process of dying and being reborn. And so this Brahmin text also being a wrong view, and it talks about the self which has consciousness, yeah, and goes to the body related to consciousness. It also here, same as in the previous sutta, it defines consciousness almost as a self. For the Brahmins, those words were almost synonyms, right? So I think also that's why the Buddha, he borrowed this concept but twisted it around. And if that doesn't make sense, don't worry about it. That wasn't my main point this morning, but I had to do it really quickly so we can have a lunch.
It seems to be a recurring problem. We had to do things quickly.
We had some technical problems. So if you take those out, we would have done pretty well.
So to do it, how many sessions do you think we need to do it properly? Thomas suggested 12, but maybe that's not enough.
Yeah? 12.
Yeah. Once you have more, you kind of explain. Infinite. Yeah. Anyway, so we happy?
Everybody happy?
Yeah.
If not?
Yeah. If not, tough luck. Is that what it is? No. No, that's naughty. So anyway, so let's go and have lunch, and we'll see you back again at quarter past 12.